Welcome to the Monsters of Fantasy. This was written, produced, recorded, and edited by me, Sean McCarter. Monsters of Fantasy is a production in which I will explore the truly horrific side of the fantasy world known as Dungeons and Dragons. There are content warnings in the show notes below. Episode 29, The Red Slad.
Hello. I've already given this one a cursory read. I'm a bit revolted by a few things. First are the monsters in question. Slads. If you haven't heard of them, then cut this recording off now and live in blissful ignorance. Slads are a rarity to most of the folk on the material plane, and it should stay that way. They are voyagers of the deep limbo. Little to nothing is known about their societies, but we do know much about them from the ones we've captured and studied. That brings us to the second thing. By we, I mean my gracious boss Nico, Dr. Linsec from one of our previous entries, the Aluvant twins, and our dear friend Professor Magil. That brings us to today's story. It's a statement taken from Michael Aluvant regarding a voyage he and his colleagues took to explore what they refer to as Limbo. I know they are real, the gods. We see their works as creations built all around us like the pillars of heaven. What makes a god, though? I used to believe it was the power that defined a god. But then I saw mere elves shape and bend reality to what any peasant would call a god. Then I began to think about it in terms of finality, mortality. Gods can't die, right? Then I saw the ways men have cheated the grips of death. It wasn't even that hard for a practitioner of the arts like me. I sought power to rival the gods, maybe to even become one, a vanity only my sister may understand. I didn't want to bring my sister along on this journey. I didn't want to share the fame and power with her. But it seems she took most of the fame, and I got most of the power. Can't say it was a bad trade. Even now, at the end, I can't say it was a bad trade. Molly was the one to first introduce me to Vivian Linsec. I went a whole year under Professor Magil's tutelage without saying anything to the class that wasn't necessary for the assignments. I spent my days and nights alone in my study, absorbing the great knowledge of my predecessors, perfecting and crafting my art just as a painter must wet his easel every night, while my sister and her friends wasted their time at the Arcane University. I refuse to lose any ground in this war for power. Then, like the clever little Molly she is, she tricked me into losing that passion and desire. And for that, I blame her wholeheartedly. Not for our predicament, of course. That is all my fault. No, I blame her for making me fall in love. It wasn't a fast or spontaneous relationship. It started as a guided studying for her and Molly. It took some flattery, but I couldn't let my sister fail, and if her needy friend was there, then so be it. The weekly study sessions turned into morning coffees, and the morning coffees into afternoon teas. I knew it had gotten bad when Molly invited me and her to the theater. I can say with confidence that I had never been to an auditorium or theater unless it was for a conference with like-minded individuals or seminars from wielders of the arcane. But when she and Viv came to my dormitory asking to see a play in a few hours, I didn't hesitate in saying yes. 6 months passed like that, in a limbo of the three of us tending classes and spending our spare time together. It had always been me and Molly, or rather, Molly always seems to follow me. But now she had let this other person get close to me, and I think, and thank, and she had a plan in it from the beginning. 2 years had passed after having slain a banshee alongside Vivian. It was our first day's assignment of our class on planar travel. Professor Maudrell had us go to the ethereal plane and slay a banshee to weed out the weak ones, I believe. And at the time, I couldn't even care less for the girl whose name I had not known. But I'm glad that girl stayed, because 2 years later, Vivian and I were attending theaters without the need of Molly. Study dates were less and less study, and more dates. Somehow 3 years in a wonderful sea of happiness had passed, and it was time for us to decide how we'd serve the king. I'd always hoped to make the mantle of an archmage, and Vivian, through very concrete words, was determined to travel and know everything. At times I was worried about how fond she looked at Professor Maudrell and his classes, but she assured me it was purely academic. My grades and talents were exceptional, and I'm positive that Archmage Sabian would have taken me on as an apprentice, or at least given me a fair run over that Sparks kid. But I didn't want it. I wanted to study, travel, and understand the limits of our universe, right alongside Vivian, who by that summer could legally be called Dr. Linsec. Something she would insist on after Professor Maudrell presented her with her degree and the job offer to work full-time, under the name of the Crown, as the new lead researcher into interdimensional travel. As the new lead researcher, her first act was hiring me as an assistant. I got a lot of flack for it at first from some of the more tactical wizards who went to the front lines to fight that year. Some did services for the king that could only require an arcane user. Some became soldiers, some teachers. But because of my knowledge and power, all of my professors would have eagerly let me become a researcher. Some even hoped I would helm my own division into the origins of abyssal power and how it ties into evocation and necromancy. That's why they thought I kept taking Professor Maudrell's classes. But when Vivian got the credit for helming this department, I made sure to let them all know that it was her study, and it was her research. Despite that I had better grades, both in practical and theory, I was just there to help her see her dreams. Molly stayed at the school as a teacher. I don't remember her ever expressing interest, but she moved to one of the off-campus buildings that helped teach kids who've tapped into their arcane abilities on how to control them at a young age. She also seemed to be the number one fan of me and Vivian. She would come by our office at times to help bounce ideas off of, chat, bring us food, tell us the latest news. She was our tether to the reality we were trying to leave. It took us a full year before we made any real breakthroughs, but when it was made, we were able to set up a tether to one of the furthest outreaches known to man. I hate to say it like that, because you may not truly envision what a great feat Vivian accomplished. On the very border of where man has gone and the great wheel cosmology, we found a foothold. On the maps, it has been referred to as Limbo, but never in history has man set foot into that realm. Until now. Though previously impossible, Vivian made a connection to the Limbo plane, without the aid of going through the ethereal one. We found this connection late one Friday afternoon after Vivian had accidentally teleported an apple there. The incident left a tear in our reality above our teleportation circle, and then after sending a few materials we could trace through the portal, we finally understood our discovery. We did a few tests first, sent in familiars and monsters dominated by spells to see if we could breathe the air. We tested how time affected the creatures inside. The last thing we wanted was to enter this new world of chaos and immediately implode or age upon ourselves. There was a sense of death that had to be overcame when dealing with any new world discoveries. You can't just find something no man has discovered and not be cautious. But maybe we could have done more. After finding out that the air wasn't harmful and that the gravity wouldn't flatten our test subjects, we sent them out scouting as best we could. What they saw was much similar to the plains that bordered the elemental ones. The plains of chaos, seas of rock floating on air, except it was far more tame than the plains of chaos. The rocks here drifted leisurely through the sky, distant dots of black in a sea of almost white. There was a hint of pink to everything, as if painted with the strokes of a watercolor artist. The portal to Limbo anchored us to a point that was suspended in space and had no real surface. Occasionally large chunks of rock would swirl by that could be used as a platform for probing. These rocks varied from small boulders the size of a fist floating no faster than a bumblebee, or rocks the size of mountains blown about as if they were leaves in a hurricane. Such an odd feeling of peaceful dissonance with a soft pink sky and the chaotic pattern of the lightning storms from no clouds. Sourceless wind sent projectiles of rock in every direction, and eventually, one of them lined up perfectly with the portal. A rock, brownish in color, and as long and flat as the countrysides of Voron, came creeping towards us on the fourth day of studying the portal. Vivian convinced me that this would be a waste to not take the opportunity, and that this was the time to make history. After grabbing a few supplies to make records, a bag of holding to collect samples, and both our staffs, we hurled ourselves into the chaos of Limbo. I was aware of the subjective gravity, something seen in a few other realms close to the border of chaos, but it still felt like I had left my stomach back in the material plane. The world which had once been upright spun on itself and folded into infinite layers of pink, until eventually it was as vast and limitless as the gods themselves. The gods were angry and showing me their power as lightning bolts charged the air around us, flashes of dark red and blue. In that chaotic vastness, I saw Vivian already willing herself to float towards the floating continent. Seeing it in person and not through the distorted eyes of a cat familiar or the warp of the portal made me realize just how vast the rock we had seen was. And as we descended into the massive rock, we noticed that it was not entirely flat. Clearly shaped and weathered by something, there were small rises and duvets to the land. I called out to Vivian, and she looked back at me with the most chaotic glee she could have. Of course, she would have been beyond anxious. In a few moments, she would be the first humanoid to set foot in Limbo. There was no fanfare or monumental shift after the exchange, but as soon as Vivian had made contact, I couldn't help but feel uneasy, worried. Nothing happened. We ended up spending 3 hours in Limbo collecting rocks and samples. The only thing to ever disturb us was the occasional collision of a rock into the one we were standing on, but that was so big, it only felt like a minor earthquake. The other issues were the strikes of lightning. None had come for us, but it was apparent that being hit by one would probably spell the end of us. Scorch marks the size of meteorite craters could occasionally be found, and somewhere far off in the distance, we heard rocks snapping loudly, to shortly later see new chunks of them, the size of small houses, floating off in the distance. It was shortly after that incident we decided to wrap it up for the day. Vivian went back to the spot she had originally landed and dubbed it Linsect Point, even planted a tiny flag with a V there. We carved a teleportation circle into the rock to get us back to our lab, and in a flash, got out of there. Because of that teleportation circle and the excess of materials as an anchor, we were able to make it back to that same rock no matter how far it floated away from the portal. Luckily, too, for the portal we ripped open in the beginning started to close. Originally wide enough to fit a Goliath, with ease it had shrunken so I could barely squeeze my body through, and that was only after 6 days of use. We didn't think it would last long enough for us to publish an official paper on our studies and findings. So Vivian, in all of her splendor, used her pinnacle of arcane abilities to teleport us back to that same spot daily. It took 9 days to truly find a shred of life. Occasionally we would see artifacts adrift in the pastel void, and they resembled tools, potentially weapons. We took what we could to our office, and it was evident that the rocks had been sharpened for some purpose, maybe a tool. fabrics made of form material that seemed like clothing spiraling in the wind. We kept collecting and looking for more evidence of another species, intelligent or not. Vivian found that species. I was across a ridge, not even a stone's throw away, when a blood-curdling scream pierced the silent air. I bolted straight up with my heart racing, blood beating against my eardrums, trying to push out the sounds of Vivian's wail and the twisted roaring that accompanied it. I saw a large red stain painted on the world. Two, actually. But the first I noticed was the large gash in Vivian's arm. She ran screaming, grasping her wound as bloody fingers weaved protective sigils. Behind her, it was stalking her. Long frog-like limbs that it seemed to dance upon as it ran after her. Each time it struck at Vivian, long onyx daggers threatened to break her shield. It was trying to claw its way into her, through her, and it was smiling. I saw the blood trailing off slender claws, and then everything went hot and red. I had slammed my staff into the ground without realizing it, uttered the forbidden words of power, and felt my body tremble without realizing it. I was shaking, and the world was shaking. I fell to my knees and opened my eyes. Behind the monstrosity streaked four comets of rock, pulled from the worlds around us. I blinked later, and the air was filled with ash and smoke. Rocks flew in every direction, and the heat, oh God, the heat. It kissed my face like the god Apollo himself, but like the immense power of the gods, I sculpted every inch of that destruction towards that thing. The smoke faded enough to show a wobbling, but otherwise no more damaged Vivian. I dropped the remains of the smoldering staff, its power spent, and collected her. We postponed any real traversing of Limbo for two more days. We first rushed Vivian back to our plane of existence and used some balms and potions on the wound. We then monitored her for 24 hours to make sure she would have no adverse reactions. A stressful time for both of us, conflicted on telling our old Professor Magill, or even my sister, versus keeping this a secret. I wanted to notify them both right away, of course, but Vivian had some kind of look on her face. It was a look she'd always get when talking about the Great Wheel cosmology, or when discussing the next plane to travel to. The look of exploration. And now we were both certain we had discovered something never before seen in our world. And killed it. It was obvious we've killed him. His remains were nothing but ashes and blood. I went back on the second day to try and retrieve anything to bring back for test, but could find nothing. Not even bones. If it had bones. Vivian was determined to have proof of this creature before we turned for help. And so after we made sure she was fine, and an additional 5 days of no limbo for her, we went back into the world. We went in more prepared this time. Weapons and spell scrolls for protection, even potential entrapments for the monster. We took a few different ones in case it happened to be able to escape from spheres of ice or telekinetic chains. We even brought voice-commanded hemp rope. We took about a dozen different measures to not see anything for weeks. It wasn't until we were halfway into our second month of observations did we finally see another of these monstrosities. Vivian had started calling them slads. She didn't really give any detailed reasoning, just said that it felt right. This time, though, we happened upon them. Two of these slads, one red and another a much larger and grotesque-looking freak of a deepish blue. They were fighting, to put it simply. That's what had drawn us to them. We kept up on them, and as Vivian instructed, watched. There was a clear tension between the two, as they stared, looking at one another, silently, mouthing their long frog-like lips. There was no language spoken, but the silence was only broken by spouts of baring teeth and claw slashing. Eventually, this debate they were having escalated, and with moments blood was drawn. The two toad-like behemoths clawed at one another, the teeth ripped flesh from flailing limbs, and as soon as the fight started, the red one laid motionless in a heap of his own limbs. The blue one roared in defiance like it was threatening any others that might be near. After it finished its bleeding, though, it ran off quickly across the rocky landscape, leaping from jagged rock to jagged rock, a blue dot bouncing in a field of red earth. Vivian went to go follow after it, but I grabbed her in the moment and was able to convince her to bring the body back for research instead. She agreed, and we quickly teleported the creature's body back to the material plane. We went on to study and dissect the monster without sleep for the next 48 hours. Then, more countless weeks with just as technical but not as extensive means of testing. All of those notes and discoveries added to the massive catalog of information we had about Limbo. The list goes on from notes of its autonomy, resistance to certain alchemical processes, and how it reacts to different extremities in its environment. Our paper, The Life of a Slad, could already be seen through the fragments of our research. The discovery of a new monster. We were almost ready to unveil the secret to Molly, if not our old professor. We even scheduled her over for a dinner that weekend, in which we planned to show her the fruits of our labor. She had gotten suspicious of all our time spent in the office alone. She was speculating we were onto something big. She thought it was some breakthrough in the elemental planes. She had no idea the mess we had gotten into. 3 days before the dinner was supposed to happen, Vivian fell under an unbelievable fever. It hit her as hard as it did fast. Her internal temperatures were skyrocketing, and the fever was accompanied by chest pains. She was slow to wake that morning, staying bedridden for most of the day. At first I thought it was the common flu. Deadly by all rights, but nothing we shouldn't have been able to handle. I went out to the apothecary to get something that could possibly help her. After explaining to the pharmacist her symptoms, she gave me a basket filled with wormwood, mint leaves, and powdered coriander. She told me to make a paste and rub it in the areas that seemed to pain Vivian. I hadn't left her alone for no more than half an hour, but upon my return to our shared home, she was nowhere to be found. Instead, tacked to the back door was the scratchy handwriting of Viv's.
Dear Michael, I have left the office to get some supplies. Then I'll be going to our special little place. Please don't be scared. I am so happy. Love, your doctor.
The handwriting was hard to read, and hadn't I watched that same hand for the past 5 years write essays, even I may have not been able to put together her fevered scrawls. Our special little place. The day Professor Majel had taught her to planar shift, he had given her a gift. Her very own private demiplane. Not much of a space, honestly. A pure white void that we could go into if we needed to escape. In the early weeks of our relationship, we tried hiding it from Molly, and it became our special little place. Quickly, though, that coy attitude of hiding only proved troublesome, and the demiplane, to my knowledge, had been turned into a very elaborate closet. Now, when I picture that room, I just see the white walls. Sitting in front of those walls is a single metal table with various instruments and tools resting on it. There is an equally bland stool sitting in front of it, quill and paper resting slightly. In the center of the void was a stretcher, like the ones they use to bring back the wounded from war. In the center of it is Vivian staring at me with her shimmering eyes. Much of the light faded from them, but still beaming like the young woman I knew who wanted to travel the multiverse. She started rambling incoherent thoughts about something inside of her. I tried shushing her, telling her it was a fever, but when she grasped my hands and made me promise to record her final moments, I knew she wasn't lying. She knew something then that I did not, and she had come to terms with it. Loved it. I would like to say her final moments were peaceful, but far from it. The night went on in screams of agony paired with the occasional vomiting that crescendoed into the night. At its pinnacle, Vivian screamed and thrashed, arcing against the floor as if a magnet was hoisted on the ceiling and was forcing her chest to move. Each thrust, she winced in pain, but like I promised her, I wrote down every moment of her suffering. The rhythmic writhing of her body timed with the scratching of my pen. In one final thrust, her chest rose, bone and blood jettisoned out, tainting our special little place. I shrieked out her name, but was met with silence for the first time since I'd arrived. I called out her name again, softer this time, and in response her chest moved. Revolted, with tears streaming down my face, I peered into the cavity and saw what I could only guess was a slad in its infancy. A blue maggot-like creature sat in a pool of her blood. It had teeth that rounded the rim of its mouth, dripping with dark crimson. And just imagine those sharp little teeth burrowing through Viv. Imagine the pain it caused her. She kept a smile on her face through it all. And now that precious smile was gone. I reached in and grabbed the wriggling creature. It seemed to have no eyes or limbs, just a fleshy blue mass with teeth the size of a baby. No words were spoken, just the ebbing of hate boiling up inside me and releasing as a small inferno consumed the creature. It writhed in flames, not trying to bite me, but swinging its mouth wildly in my palms. It screamed as it turned to ash in my hands, or so I think. All the sound was drowned out by my own sobbing.
Well, that's the end of that story. A horrible ending for our dear friend Vivian. There is more here. A lot more. It seems that we have all the notes these two took on Slads, and even a few other entries. I've gone and looked through them all, and unfortunately it seems the story does not end there. I have to believe Nico wants me to separate the two by how he presented them, clearly making a distinction between the other colors. So without going into what we'll cover next week, here's all we know about the Red Slad. Well, first, I'll say they, and I mean Professor Magill and Michael and his sister, continued researching into the Slad and found out they can come in at least 4 known colors, blue, red, gray, and green. Despite being eerily similar to each other, the different colors prefer to stay separate to one another, going as far as fighting to the death when brought face to face. Physiology. A red slad stands anywhere from 8 to 10 feet tall, and weighs almost 200 pounds once it reaches adulthood. They are similar to the amphibians of our realm in their life cycle. They start off as tadpoles, and will eventually grow legs and arms. It's a slow process that takes almost a full year, but once done, the slad will be considered fully grown, at which point it is ready to reproduce. Asexually, of course. They are mostly organic, despite living in one of the border realms of chaos. Surprising, though, because from what I've heard about many of these distant realms, it could have well just been a sentient ball of slime. Actually, it does seem that having been birthed in limbo, it's given the slads a bit of an advantage. Their skin is covered with a slimy film that gives it a unique resistance. Weaknesses and resistances. The slad has an innate resistance to lightning, fire, frost, and acid-based attacks, both mundane and magical. It is believed in the film of the mucus that gives the slad its protection. However, it seems that sharp objects and mundane objects do just fine against the slad. That is, if you can survive getting close enough to hurt it. Attacks and abilities. It is noted that slads have been in social settings using primitive tools. Usually not a red one, mind you, but it has been seen. The slads, however, like to stick to their natural weapons of claws and bites. And that's because of their reproductive methods. A red slad acts off of instinct to spread its genes, which it does so by impregnating its victims.
with its claws. The slads, sexless, for we found no genders to separate them, just colors, have egg sacs encased in their claws, and when they attack you, they trail and leave behind minuscule slad eggs. If the egg is able to find its way into its victim's bloodstream, it will gestate and grow for a few months, before inevitably bursting forward in a bloody mess as a brand new blue slad. More on that next week. Funny, deep in these notes I find a thread of reality. What type of life would my dear friend Charles, the kid they call Sparks, have lived if Michael Alouvant took his position? Would he still be gone? Could he have even challenged his arcane abilities? And then there's that god Apollo again. Last we heard it was in the statement about Timmy and his bats. But it's odd to Poppins put in such an odd way. It's almost as if it's an analogy not from a devout worshipper, but from a layman's mouth. Something that would roll off the tongue. However, when I go to ask Luna, who had known Michael somewhat, she said that he'd never spoke in odd tongues.
If you enjoyed today's episode, please share it with your friends and family or leave a rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Follow us on Twitter at monstersof_ for all news and teasers for upcoming episodes. This week was part one to The Slad. But don't worry, you can hear more about Michael and Molly in next week's episode. Part 2, The Blue Slad. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.